I wanted adventure and I wanted to see what's going on in the world. And so I said, look, if I'm going to do it, let's do it right. Let's really test myself here. Just out of sort of pure luck and what I thought was the coolest picture in the recruiter's book, the job that I chose was weapons of mass destruction countermeasures. Every security professional, right? You want to eventually be a chief security officer, right? You spend all those years trash talking leadership about how bad of a job, you know, they were doing as a junior manager, and you could do it so much better, right? To get the opportunity literally to go to the shipyard and build your own battleship from the ground up. And if that thing doesn't float, it's on you. That's exciting to me. Try to tell somebody no once in business. In government, no is no. In government, if I'm telling you you're not going there, you're not going there. But, you know, in business, if I tell you you're not going there, they're going to find another way to get there.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sign-In Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, good afternoon. Happy to be here.
We met down at GSX. I guess New Orleans. That was like 3 months ago, something like that.
I think it was the end of September.
We were on that panel together. And shortly thereafter, I was like, gosh, it'd be fun to talk to Josh one-on-one. So here we are. Thank you for accepting the invite. Really enjoyed that panel. So I got to hear a little bit about your background there, but I thought it would be great for our audience to kind of hear some of the same. So what I love to start with in these conversations is, how in the world did you end up in this job? Because almost no one did it on purpose. How'd you get here?
Absolutely. You know, New Orleans was fun. You know, the panel we did was almost kind of one of a kind in those events because, you know, a lot of the times you'll have panels and you'll have a bunch of vendors on the panel and maybe even somebody narrating or moderating the panel that isn't a practitioner, doesn't necessarily have that life experience. But we had a panel full of experience, and the feedback that I got from the folks in the crowd, even afterwards via emails and messages on LinkedIn, they were like, man, that was real. That was raw. That was a legitimate conversation, you know, about security today. Security leadership and what we need to do sort of going into the future. You know, it wasn't a standard, you know, presentation that happens at a lot of these conferences, right? Well, you know, make a copy of your passport when you travel abroad, you know, stuff like that. It was legitimate stuff, you know, that we need to hear, or that sometimes we might even have been bottling up, to be honest, for a little bit. And we were in a circle of trust there, and it all came out, but it was all for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the experience was really diverse. I mean, we had some folks who were not U.S. citizens on the panel who kind of arrived at security very differently than most of us. And you and I both started national security, which was neat to hear. It's always good to hear those different stories, different perspectives, which is a little bit, I'm sure we'll cover some of that difference today in what we see in sort of the national security types versus the non-national security types. But you started as a Marine, if I remember, right?
In the Marines, yes. Got into the field in the Marine Corps. I'm a guy from the woods, 10 miles outside of a small town. I grew up in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. Love Arkansas to death for sure. But yeah, I grew up about 10 miles outside of a town of about 1,200 folks. Real blue collar type family. My dad was a logger, one of the toughest jobs there is on earth. So yeah, I grew up out there. So, you know, rough tumble upbringing, and you play sports and you do all these things where you learn those leadership traits. You learn to be tough from your dad, and he was a tough guy. But you really learn those leadership traits early on from your coaches, right? Your football coaches, your baseball coaches. And I was lucky enough to have some that were just icons. I mean, my head football coach, he's passed now, but I mean, he's in the Hall of Fame for coaches in the state of Arkansas. That's how much of an icon this individual was. 30 years there at the school, and came from the town, played at the school, state champion at the school as a quarterback. So, you know, you learn those leadership traits. And so I was searching for that, you know, searching, and I had an adventurous spirit, you know, how can I get outside of these Ozark Mountains of Arkansas, which I really didn't know what life outside of it even looked like, to be honest with you. You know, my first airplane ride was to San Diego, right? Was to MCRD San Diego boot camp when I was 18. So, but that's what I wanted, you know? So the Marines was interesting to me. I said, you know, the military, I was a good student, a really good student. I could have went that path initially right out of high school, but I wanted something more, man. I wanted adventure, and I wanted to see what's going on in the world. And so I said, look, if I'm going to do it, you know, if I'm going to join the military, let's do it right. Right. Let's really test myself here. And so that's why I decided on the Marine Corps. And yeah, no real, I had some uncles. I had an older uncle that was in the Army right about the end of Vietnam. And then I had actually a great grandfather, and I didn't even know this individual. He was already passed by the time I was born, but he was a Marine during World War I. And I really didn't learn his story, you know, until I was already in the Marines or out, you know what I mean? So it wasn't like a family tradition or anything is what I'm saying. I was like one of one, the first to kind of go do that. So yeah, let's join the Marines. And then just out of sort of pure luck and what I thought was the coolest picture in the recruiter's book, the job that I chose was weapons of mass destruction countermeasures. So nuclear, biological, chemical defense. I mean, dudes were running around in gas masks and there was clouds of green and yellow smoke. I mean, it looked super cool. I didn't know anything about it, but I knew it looked cool. And so that's what I chose. And of course, it turned out to be quite relevant later on in life.
I have to do a pop culture call out on this because I actually started in WMD too. I was at CIA. I was in non-proliferation, so spent a lot of time, mostly nuclear for me. But lately, I've been watching a show called Pluribus. Have you heard about the show?
It's on my list.
All right, so Pluribus, the whole initial thing is, I won't spoil any plot points, but it features U.S. AMRID and U.S. AMRID's facility.
Oh, okay, yep.
And some stuff happens. And I immediately thought of Pluribus when I reread your bio, and I was like, well, you know. If alien viruses come to infect the human race, those folks, the WMD military folks, will probably be at the point of the spear.
You know, it got real interesting, right? Like in the beginning, you know, 2000, right? So this is May 2000, summer 2000. By the time you go through boot camp and do all that stuff, you know, out in the mountains of Southern California, and then eventually go to my school, right? My occupational school. It actually had a U.S. Army base in Missouri. Fort Leonard Wood is pretty backwoods. They call it Fort Lost in the Woods for a reason. I was there, and there's a Marine detachment there where we do the training on the Army base using their facilities, but we're trained with just Marines. And then I ended up out in 29 Palms, California, at 1st Tank Battalion, 1st Marine Division, out in the high desert. And that was my first experience with the desert at all. And I found myself for probably the next 15 years, for some reason, never being able to escape the desert.
How long were you in the Marines before you ended up at State Department? Not long thereafter, if I remember.
So I was in the Marines for 4 years. I joined before 9/11. So I joined in May 2000, just about a year before 9/11. So I was in right during the kickoff to the global war on terror, the great unknown of who attacked us, why, and where are we going. But obviously very eager to go and do what we had to do. 1st Tank Battalion and most of 1st Marine Division really started, we got into the fight in Iraq in 2003. In January, we pushed over to Kuwait. We staged up there on the border. And then, you know, we led the 1st Tank Battalion, my unit. We led the division and pretty much all allied forces into Iraq. March 20th, I believe, 2003 was when we crossed that line of departure and pretty much hit every major city on the way up to Baghdad, you know, leading the division up there in March and April. So it was an interesting time for sure. But it was a young guy. I mean, I think I was 21 at the time, Marine. This is what every Marine lives for, right? And that's what it was. And especially being the CBRN or chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear defense chief for my battalion, I spent a lot of my time in the command element there helping advise the leadership on if we were to encounter this type of environment, which was a real risk, a real threat, right? In those early days, this is how we do it. This is how we maneuver around it. This is what I'm going to do to help you figure out where that contamination is, what it is, who's impacted, and how do we stay in the fight in these contaminated environments. So that was really kind of my role, my job there.
I mean, I think people now, I mean, you know, we're so removed from that conflict and what it was like. I don't think people really remember, or certainly not younger people, that when that conflict started, everybody really thought that there were very bad weapons of mass destruction and that he would probably use them on us. That was the expectation. And so there aren't that many people who've really been in an active conflict zone who have to really think about how to defend a unit against weapons of mass destruction, and you're one of them, which is crazy.
Yeah, I think my team was four. I had a warrant officer. And then I had myself as the chief, and then I had a couple, you know, non-NCOs, BFCs, Lance Corporals, one that was PFC Lance Corporal. You know, you're one of just a handful, and people are looking to you to make those decisions as a 21-year-old guy. You know, and you really got to lay back on that foundation and go back to your learning, go back to your education and all that training. We were very fortunate to have battalion commanders that were hardcore training. We were always in the field out there in 29 Palms. It's perfect for it, you know, the desert, right? We had, you know, leaders that were always wanting to bring in that WMD scenario. So in the field exercise, you're going through, you're doing assaults, you're doing counter assaults, you know, moving tanks and moving units. But before we leave here on this 3-day or 5-day or 7-day field op, we're going to have a WMD portion of that, right? Where the whole unit's going to exercise their response and how they operate in that environment. So luckily enough, we were ready. I feel we were super ready. But if you look back, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction at one time because he used them against his own people in the late 80s up in the Kurdish area in Halabja, right? Where he used a combination of nerve agents, blood agents, and blister agents in a large scale. Right. And there's video footage of that happening. And so, you know, I've got my own theories on where they were, why they weren't there when we were there. But when you sit on somebody's doorstep for a couple months, I mean, and tell them why you're going to come across, I think you probably got some time to put some stuff under the carpet. You know what I mean? So
for sure. For sure. But nonetheless, it must have been a pressure cooker for you guys.
Yeah. Interesting time. Pressure cooker for sure. I think it really molded me as a young leader under pressure, somebody able to be in those environments, being comfortable in the uncomfortable, you know, whether it's wartime, you know, whether it's later on down my career where we'll talk about, you know, major natural disasters or the, you know, Arab Spring or other things where you're in these leadership roles and having to carry out, you know, these, your crisis management plans, you know, that really, you have to save people's lives, right, to get them out of there. So got my start there. And then 2004, so after my, you know, that 4-year enlistment, decided, hey, okay, let's go see what the other side of the life is like. And, you know, I was lucky enough. I went through this transition class, right? They call it the Transition Assistance Program, TAPS, right? And you put in your MOS or your number, your job, right? You put in your job into this computer system and where you live or where you want to live when you get out, right? One job popped up that aligned with my skill set. And it was, you know, weapons of mass destruction, countermeasures instructor. And it was a Department of Homeland Security contract role doing mobile training teams around the United States. And it just so happened to be based out of the Pine Bluff Arsenal there in Arkansas, right? There in South Arkansas, which Pine Bluff Arsenal has a huge history of being a stockpile for chemical weapons for the U.S., you know, during World War II and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, one job, and I was lucky enough to get it, or else it would have been bad news.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Sometimes that placement process doesn't go that well.
Oh, man. Yeah. I couldn't believe that. I was like, whoa, man, I'm lucky here. The coolest thing about this role was I would travel around the United States and I was responsible for training police officers, firefighters, paramedics, and emergency management departments, whether at the city or the county or even the state level, on how to respond to a WMD incident in their jurisdiction. So the people that I'm with in and around every single day, it's a brotherhood just like the military was, right? Firefighters bust each other's chops just like Marines bust each other's chops. So it was a good transition in that way. I found that crowd, right, where a lot of people struggle with that transition, being out of those like-minded individuals that you've lived with for the last number of years. But I was able to be there and work with those folks just all over the United States. It was a lot of fun. Really cool places I got to go to and spend weeks training their entire departments, you know, 2, 3, 4 shifts worth of firefighters on a week-long course. So that means, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks of training there. So it was really good. I'll blame it on youth and stupidity. You know, I was still in my 20s, so I had that out at that time. I said, hey, let's get back to the Middle East and, you know, see what's going on there, right? I kind of missed it a little bit. So I took a job. What could possibly go wrong, right? Well, I took a job. It was actually an expat job. So I was an expatriate living in Kuwait City, just outside Kuwait City. Had an apartment, had a company, Toyota Hilux, which, you know, they've got their own reputation.
Yeah.
I love those trucks. And but what I did was I was basically like a WMD or CBRN advisor for the Army Area Support Group Kuwait and other Army units, command elements in the region, right? So I lived there in Kuwait City. I would move all around the region there in the Middle East doing different types of training, evaluation, preparedness, because still with all the buildup of troops in the region, there was a legitimate threat, you know, from Iran and other places where we were in very close proximity in missile range, right? So they needed to prepare for the likelihood of that. So that was my job. And so, you know, it was a lot of fun, but it was 6-7 days a week and 135 degrees in the shade in Kuwait in the summertime. So like, all right, I'm good for about a year and a half here. And then, you know, let's get back stateside. So yeah, it was good. I'm glad I did it. It was really, really interesting. But then comes the fun part is I found myself fielding phone calls from the Department of State, you know, from the U.S. Department of State. And they had reached out to me before I went to Kuwait and I kind of brushed them off. I didn't fully know really what the Department of State was at that time. And then you get over there abroad and you interact with the embassy there in Kuwait City and you learn a little bit more about that department and the diplomatic security service and things like that, what they do. And so when the second chance came back around for to join that very small team there in the Department of State, the WMD countermeasures team, I jumped on it. And so that was my exit from the Middle East, living there and spending a significant amount of time there. But little did I know, the experience that I had there was an easy marker for people to say, hey, we got to go back to these Middle Eastern posts. Josh, you're familiar. Why don't you go ahead and take that mission? So I spent tons of time there in the next decade of my life. So WMD countermeasures in the State Department, small but mighty team. And, you know, similar mission set. It was really preparing the department, both the domestic footprint of the department and international. So, you know, the international footprint of the Department of State is embassies, consulates, and missions in almost 200 countries, right? I think at the time I was there, it was like 177, 179. But, you know, there's new countries that pop up all the time and new missions that pop up all the time. So go out there and prepare the department around the world for the likelihood of a WMD type scenario. And that could be, it could be a wartime type scenario, or it could be something as simple, even though it's not simple, it's very complex, as a powdered letter or an anthrax type letter coming to the mailroom in the embassy, which happened all the time. Luckily, the majority of the time they were false, but the response is the same every single time. It could be somebody walking up in the Eastern Bloc of Europe with some radiological material and saying, hey, I have this nuclear material and I want to trade this for a visa to the U.S. So there's all sorts of things that happen out there in the wild, wild world. And so I was really there with that team helping manage that for a number of years. Lots of fun. Saw the world, really. I mean, outside of the couple of countries that I visited in the Marine Corps, I really got to see the world there during my time in the State Department. So I definitely owe them that for sure. And all the frequent flyer miles, they owe me that too. But midway during my time in the State Department, I found myself transitioning from that WMD-centric, WMD-heavy-focused role over to crisis management. Weapons of mass destruction countermeasures, it is crisis management. It's risk management. It's emergency response. It's emergency management. But it's for a very specific niche threat, right? There's dozens of them, but it's a very specific, this much of the pie. When you're talking about the threat spectrum. A few years into my time at State, I became a crisis management officer. So now I did risk management and crisis management for all hazards, all threats. So it could be a WMD incident, or it could be an embassy under siege, right? Say Yemen, for example, which a lot of people don't know, but that embassy there has been overran more times than any other embassy in history. I've been lucky, fortunate enough to be there a couple of times. You know, there's not helping them prepare for those sorts of things. And then on the other end of the phone, you know, when they do happen as a crisis management officer. So, you know, all hazards, all risks. So that really opened up my blinders. That opened up opened me up to everything bad in the world, I guess you would say, and really sort of honing your skills on helping manage those crises wherever they happen, whenever they might happen, and at whatever scale it might be. You know, it could be one individual in trouble abroad. It could be a whole embassy in trouble because there's people outside the gate that are mad at them. It could be a whole country in trouble because, you know, there's been a war breakout between, say, Israel and Palestine, which happened all the time. And you've got 20,000 Americans that you've got to get out of there because, you know, that's the State Department's responsibility is to help, you know, help those Americans get out of there. And so, you know, when you're on the other end of the phone or you're there in the operations center, you know, as a crisis management officer, that's part of it. So, you know, exposure to a lot of things, you know, a lot of things there. I was in the State Department during Arab Spring. Really interesting time. You know, the drawdown or evacuation of dozens of embassies and consulates across North Africa and the Middle East. And that's really where, as a crisis management person, we really honed our craft during that time. You know, we're really able to take a look at our playbooks and your crisis management plans, say, hey, what works and what doesn't. But after that time, I think we were the whole department, and there's all sorts of teams that, within the department that do crisis management. It wasn't just my team. We really honed our craft during that time. So we were there. I was in the State Department during the Japan triple disaster. So Fukushima, the tsunami, which resulted in the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear plant, right? Which goes back to my WMD roots, right? Nuclear radiological, earthquake, tsunami, radiation, right? The triple disaster and, you know, the post there in Tokyo and the multiple consulates there in Japan having to manage through that scenario, right? See if we've got American citizens in the area, help get them out. Where's this contamination at relevant to the embassies and consulates? So, you know, that was an interesting time. And then, of course, I was there during Benghazi as well, which was a display of crisis management not working how it should. But there were specific reasons.
Not the kind of, you don't want any crisis, but that one was a little bit more self-inflicted. It's a little bit more of a communications problem.
Yes, it was. And it's the protocol and the communications and all that was there. We had honed, everybody responsible for managing and responding to crises had honed those skills over the last number of years with these gigantic crises. They're fully capable of managing that sort of incident. Not to say there wouldn't have been a loss of life because of just the type of incident it was, but it was a failure in crisis management, but it wasn't necessarily, I would say, because of the crisis management professionals within the department, let's just say.
Yes, sometimes there's only so much cleanup you can do. The mess is too big. Well, you did this for a while, and then you did what everybody does after they work in crisis management and WMD. You went to work for Walmart.
That's right. Right. I know. Like, yeah. Going around the world talking about weapons of mass destruction and bad things happening and in Walmart. Like, you know, did they give me a blue vest? Did I have to wear a blue vest or what?
So, because, you know, the UPS, even if you're hired as an executive, right, you have to go work a truck for a while. Do you have to, you have to be a greeter for a couple of days?
Yes. So not a greeter, but yeah, we absolutely 100%. You've got to understand, and that's a lesson that I take to this day. You've got to understand the business. You've got to be a student of the business, right? So even if you're up there at corporate and you're in global security and you're not necessarily dealing with sales and things like that, you're dealing with, say, earthquakes in Mexico that close hundreds of stores, you really still need to know what that store-level employee is going through day to day. So yeah, every single year, there were multiple days where your team would go out there and throw on the vests and go stock shelves, go Yeah, go work cash register, go shag carts from the parking lot and bring them in. And that was absolutely expected. And you learn a lesson from that. And the lesson that I learned from that was be a student of the business first, right? Understand it doesn't matter. You could be the most high-speed global security guy out there or gal out there. It's not as simple as laying down a template on this new job or new company that you just started with. And you got to understand the ins and outs of that business. And then you bring your craft into it, right, to help them accomplish their goals in a more safe, secure, right fashion, create that environment for them to be successful in what they do, right? Walmart was where I saw that on display.
That was, just to be clear, you were hired to do a security job.
I wasn't hired to be a greeter.
I started with the joke, and I want to make sure everybody knows that that was just a joke.
In fact, that's right.
It was security.
That's right.
So what were you hired to do? So you go to Walmart. What was the mission at Walmart?
The global security organization there was fairly good size. And my initial role there, and it was really interesting, my time in there in Walmart, every role that I changed, I wasn't always successful in dropping the pack of the old role and putting on a new one of the new role. I always seemed to have to take that one with me and then throw on another pack on top of it, if that makes sense. So my first role was like a risk manager, right? Risk manager, crisis manager. So, you know, understanding the risk landscape and my focus specifically in the beginning was Americas, right? And also on the executive, the executive portfolio from like a protective intelligence standpoint. And I ended up building that program out. The second year I was there, I moved over specifically to focus more on protective intelligence, but it was risk management, crisis management. And a lot of the international experience that I had was leveraged early on heavily. One of the first larger crises at Walmart that I helped manage, that I really took the lead on, was the Ferguson, Missouri civil unrest. If you remember that, that was really the start to, in the first incident of the Mike Brown officer involved shooting, killing, right, there in Ferguson, Missouri. That was what kicked off this large-scale civil unrest as a thing. It was the beginning there in Ferguson or the St. Louis, right, suburb. So, but just like what happens, there always seems to be a Walmart in close proximity to something bad happening. And it, all the events happened on Florissant Avenue. At one end of the avenue was the courthouse where all the protests and things were taking place. At the opposite end of the avenue was a Florissant Walmart. So right in the middle. So we're helping them, you know, manage that. What do we do? Do we stay open? Do we stay closed? How do we barricade the store? How do we interact and liaise with law enforcement at all different levels? Luckily, we were calling into the state, talking to the state police and federal and all that sort of stuff. Managing that, that was a weeks-long crisis and really kind of showed me domestically what civil unrest can look like, right? Because I was used to it internationally, right? Arab Spring was massive civil unrest, especially when you're talking about Cairo and Egypt and those things. But what it could look like domestically, which was new sort of to us. Yeah, so there, and then I transitioned over. I got asked to go over and build out the protective intelligence program for like the executive protection team there that protects, you know, the main officers of Walmart, right? The C-suite and the CEOs and the international CEOs and things like that. So that was really where I started digging in and learning the craft sort of operational intelligence, right? I will always say that I'm not an analyst. I'm not a classically trained intelligence analyst at all, you know, but I've been around the world enough to know and to read risk and to understand risk. So, you know, protective intelligence is very operational focused. It's not so much strategic where you're looking down the road on what's going to happen during that election or in this country or whatever. You're looking at, is this threat that I just found to my CEO or board member, is it legitimate? Who is this individual? Where are they? What's the likelihood, right, of them showing up at this major corporate event, for example, that's going to happen, you know, within a couple of weeks? So I worked hand in hand with a executive protection team there and the whole global security leadership, you know, helping build out that protective intelligence program. I helped manage, from a security perspective, large-scale corporate events. You know, so Walmart, being the size that it is, has very large shareholders meetings and associate celebrations where they bring people or associates from all over the world into Northwest Arkansas, you know, thousands, you know, 7,500, 8,500, you know, put on concerts with 20,000 people, events with 20,000 people.
Yeah, it's like it's one of the biggest employers in the world.
It is the largest outside of the U.S. government. With DOD included, it's the largest. So, you know, I did that. And then I moved over back sort of into a bigger picture, emergency management and helping manage large scale emergencies like Walmart's response to hurricanes, for example, in the United States, down here in Florida and elsewhere. I found myself deploying to the state emergency operations centers, which due to my previous experience, I had a lot of interaction and I could speak that language. So going down and being that forward sort of conduit between the crisis on the ground and all of the support around the nation and in Bentonville and helping move in water, food, product and things that frankly, it takes the government a long time to do that. Right. I mean, you always hear it in every disaster. You know, people are always talking about how slow FEMA might be, and I'm not knocking them at all. It's a government institution. Government by its nature is slow, but man, Walmart really, I mean, we were there the next morning. And we, you know, as soon as they're taking the trees off the road, we're rolling trucks of, you know, water and food and emergency supplies. And it was really cool to see that. And, you know, really cool to be a part of that too.
So Western North Carolina is in my backyard. And so I watched private organizations, including Walmart in that area, as well as some of the private nonprofits compared to the government response. And, you know, the private organizations just blew them away. It wasn't even close. And I'm curious what your thoughts on there. Is it because of, I mean, obviously, Walmart is one. I mean, this is one of the most sophisticated logistics organizations on earth. And I wonder if that's what's going on there, or is it just a culture of we're going to act? What were, when you saw Walmart responding to disaster, why were they so good at it? Why could they be there the next morning and start getting water the next day?
It's both. So obviously, you know, being a large retailer in the United States with over 5,000 retail units, and of course, dozens and dozens of distribution centers. They're not far from everywhere, right? They're within just a couple hours, probably from everywhere in the United States. So no matter what happens or where it happens, they're fairly close, both from a retail store perspective and from a distribution perspective. And they've got those pre-established pipelines. I mean, it's there, loaded on a truck and get it over there. So the network, yes, but the culture, you hit on it too, you know, the culture of really taking care of their community, and they take it serious. And, you know, Walmart was really where I learned too of companies that can have legitimate cultures. You hear everybody talk about culture, especially nowadays, you know, in the private sector, but Walmart's culture, right, of helping, you know, associates, operations, and communities, right, helping them live better every day, it's legitimate. I mean, and it's legitimate all the way up to, you know, the CEO. He lives it, he breathes it, and so does every associate there. And so we take it personal because lots of times Walmart's the largest employer in that region or in that area, especially if it's a rural area, you know, with a town of a few thousand people. Well, guess what? There's probably 400 people that work at that Walmart, right, or nearby. And so, you know, it's personal, always was personal, always at Walmart. And, you know, they really took taking care of the communities very seriously. And so I was lucky to be a part of that. And then I ended my time there at Walmart. And during that time, it helped manage domestic disasters, but also international crises all the time. And a lot of it was due to that tie-in I had with the State Department. I could very easily call over and talk to an RSO, right? It's somewhere in the world that somewhere in Walmart might be in trouble, say like a buyer or a sourcer in China, for example, that, you know, we had somebody that had a medical event there, which we had to medevac. And so, you know, I've led that and the kidnap ransom extortion events in Central America, you know, was able to lead those and get those out due to that network that I built on the public side and the State Department that helps manage a lot of those, right? But, you know, at the end of my Walmart time, I was in the international side of the house, working with all of those regional security managers all around the world, helping them build out their programs. So everything from their travel risk management program, which is probably one of the most things I'm most proud of there at Walmart, was I was able to rebuild from the ground up, obviously with the support of some great, fantastic people, but their travel risk management program that looked out for 500,000 travelers around the globe a year. Yeah, there were 500,000 itineraries flowing through the system. And so, you know, I helped rebuild that from the ground up with a team and was running that as well. And I'm really proud of that. We did some really cool things. Helped get travelers in distress out of bad situations. Medevac folks out of bad situations to get them emergency care. The last part of my time there was working with those regional leaders to help them understand and build out that travel risk management program. Help them build out, you know, say like their business continuity programs and all those sorts of things. Because they're small little groups. They're outposts, right? They're small little groups out there all around the world. They're the spokes. We're the hub. And so how do we support them and get them all of those programs, tools, and things like that that big Walmart has so that they can be successful themselves? And so that was a really, really good time. And I think a good ending to my time at Walmart, you know, once I got the call from Facebook or what's now Meta.
Zuckerberg snaps you up.
That's right.
2019. Yeah. So talk about, again, you'd think, oh, this is going to be a cool tech company. How much controversy could there possibly be?
Oh, man. That's 2019, 2020. Oh, Lord. Yeah, that was it, man. You know, I go out there they call me up. And I had planned to hang around at Walmart. You know, I'm from Arkansas. It's based there in Northwest Arkansas. Bentonville's a great area. But man, that allure of tech, right? Tech was really sexy at the time, you know? And say, hey, man, do you want to come out here and help build this protective intelligence program for us? Oh, and by the way, you're going to be building it specifically for the CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, the COO at the time, Sheryl Sandberg. You're going to have the board of directors. I'm like, whoa, like what? So we're able to, that team out there is amazing. And, you know, we were able to build a world-class team because we had the resources, right, and the support to help, again, identify, manage, assess all those threats and things that come in by the tens of millions. This is no joke. Tens of millions, right, of threats in any given year. So luckily, you're in a company with some really smart engineers that know things about natural language processing and machine learning. And so you're able to build some tools there that help your initial assessment of most of those, whittle it down to, I don't know, say tens of thousands still, you know, that you have to set eyes on. And luckily we had a good team there of managers and analysts that were really good at their craft and assess those and then work to the ones that needed to be mitigated, managed, work with the executive protection team, corporate security team, local, federal, state law enforcement, international law enforcement, sometimes depending on if that threat or that, say, like a swatting call, for example, might be originating somewhere in Europe or an island off the European coast. Now you're talking about international organizations coming into play here. So it was at a massive scale. It was at a very large scale, but it was fun. It was back out in California, which I really enjoyed. It was protective intelligence at scale. And I still don't think there's probably nobody else that does it. You know, Steve, even still to this day at the scale that they do it.
I think it was 2018, around there. So it was probably a bit before you were there. But I remember being pretty impressed. I mean, I did. You don't expect it from a tech company necessarily. Because it's, you know, the intent is to have a very open culture, you know, all the stuff. And, you know, I think they had started to outgrow the original site and they'd bought a Cisco setup on their side.
Right across the bridge in Fremont.
Exactly. Yep. And just the way that there was, I mean, number one, when you cross the threshold, like badge printed with my face on it, that very tight management practices. But yet once you kind of cross that barrier, I mean, it was obviously everybody's like they knew where it's, it felt like everybody, they knew where everybody was. But once you were inside the campuses,
the high trust area,
it was a high trust area. walked on the roof by the kombucha bars. It was great.
Yeah. How cool was that? Right. There was a fox. There's a fox living on that roof.
Oh, how about that? Well, it looked like the forest. So why wouldn't you have a fox? If I were a fox, I'd go there too and get some free kombucha.
Exactly. Yeah, the fox is living a good life. Grilled cheese.
Oh, grilled cheese.
There's a grilled cheese. They're slinging grilled cheeses out of a restaurant on top of that, on top of the roof there. So that fox is living large for sure.
I'm sure. Yeah. Since you were there, obviously you had high frequency threats, but also just, yes. I mean, you've got a couple of the more high profile senior executives on Earth. And you also were dealing with some of the controversy around, you know, I mean, there was some deplatforming stuff. There was the way that Meta was working with Congress and the FBI. All that stuff was happening at the same time, which I'm sure put a lot of strain on the security team.
Yes, it did. It all seemed to happen all at once. And then, you know, you sprinkle in a little bit of the Black Lives Matter movement there and, you know, how they orchestrated that across social media platforms and things like that. And so that's really what my couple of years there was. It was civil unrest, direct threats, global pandemic. How are we moving around? How are executives moving around during this time? How's the company operating all at once, all the time? It was an interesting time. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, you learn a lot of good lessons. You develop a lot of leadership skills and you really test yourself and test your ability to lead people through those crises because everybody is going through it themselves too, right? Everybody on your team, my team of 8 to 10 people, they're all experiencing the lockdowns or COVID. They all have family members in other states that are impacted. They're not able to see. So you're responsible for leading a crisis that you're also in the middle of, you know, so that's a whole different play in a situation and leading a team that's also in the middle of their own individual crises. I learned a lot during those couple of years and that's a great team. They're still close to those folks and they continue to do good work. But, you know, I got a call. It's usually how it happens. My wife was 8 months pregnant with her first child. It was wintertime. And, you know, a company said, hey, do you want to come go over to the Midwest, to Iowa, and be our first chief security officer? Okay. You know, I mean, every security professional, right? You want to eventually be a chief security officer, right? You spend all those years trash talking leadership about how bad of a job, you know, they were doing as a junior manager and you could do it so much better, right? Now's your shot. Let's do it. And that company was Hy-Vee. It's a very large Midwestern retailer, grocer. They got a lot of pharmaceutical stuff going on, pharmacy distribution. They've got food manufacturing, supply chain stuff. They're fairly large. The company's at that time was about 160,000 people. You know, I think they had over 550 retail units all across the Midwest. They had just gone through COVID, how that impacts their retail market. They've gone through all the civil unrest, the elections, and, you know, certain executives throwing fundraisers for certain candidates, which didn't end very well when a couple hundred people showed up outside the headquarters. And they said, hey, we might need somebody who knows how to manage these things, right? So they convinced me, and then I still have no idea. She still holds it over my head, by the way. I convinced my wife to move 8 months pregnant from Monterey, California, probably one of the most beautiful places on earth, to Des Moines, Iowa.
All right.
In a snowstorm.
Oh, boy. So you should have waited until July. I'm just saying.
I'm telling you, man, she's a great wife. And if your marriage can make it through that, it can make it through anything. You know, 8 months pregnant and I'm driving across country and we pull up in the driveway of our new house and it's literally blowing snow and 0 degrees. So, oh man, but it was a good, you know, here's your opportunity, right? Let's see what you're made of, right? Here's your first shot at the top. and let's see if you can build an organization. I did. I built out an organization of about 300 folks across supply chain security, retail security, built out an executive protection function, risk intelligence, you know, for travel risk management. They were building very large pharmaceutical distribution centers. So think about a high-speed machinery that is distributing and filling pharmaceuticals by the millions, and then that is going out to the stores, supporting the stores. And so now you're getting into the space of not only manufacturing, which was new to me, but pharmaceutical industry, which has all sorts of rules and regulations on how you secure certain things and secure those facilities and stuff. So it was a really interesting couple of years and learning experience building that out. Yeah, it was super interesting, but upper Midwest is not a place for me.
So yeah, I think you made a warmer weather move, if I remember right.
Warmer weather move. You know, that the winter that I had my son, he was born in January, born in a snowstorm, right? And, you know, he grew up his first few months inside. It's just too cold. And then he gets outside for a couple of months, you know, June, July, August. And then about the time he's back on his feet, start walking around, it's winter again. So, yeah, I just felt like he lived his life, you know, inside and in our basement. I was looking at houses out there from California, and I was like, man, every one of these houses has like a super decked out basement. These basements got bars in them. These basements got big screen TVs. Man, these basements are 2,000 square feet themselves. What's going on? Negative 46 degrees is going on outside. That's what's going on. I felt like he lived his life, you know, in that basement. I wanted more for him. And we found some warmer weather with an opportunity from Circle.
For everybody who has not yet heard of Circle, what is Circle?
Circle is a hydration technology company. You know, so Circle's in a hydration space. I've got one. I'll actually demo for you here. All right. So, yeah. So this is Circle. Super cool. This is plastic bottles, stainless steel bottles, all that. We have all that. But the bottle's not the secret sauce. The secret sauce is what we call the sip cartridge, right? So you got a flavor concentrate in the sip cartridge. And this is all one of one. I mean, this is all intellectual property. We're the only one that does it this way. We're the only one that will do it this way. But, you know, your concentrate's here in your, you know, in your sip or your flavor cartridge. And because it's in that cartridge and because it never mixes with your water in the bottle, it mixes as it touches your lips, basically. So this cartridge has valves and things in it. Mixes as it touches your lips, it makes it adjustable. So you can adjust this to say, this is fruit punch, right? So you can adjust to say, hey, I just want a little hint of fruit punch. So I'm going to adjust it to a one or a two. Or you say, I want the full experience. So you dial her up to a 9, for example. Now, when you're drinking a couple bottles full of fruit punch, you're like, hey, I need some water. You just dial it over to X, just drink straight water. So it's valved where you can do drink the water drink. So it's super cool, right?
And you joined your startup too, right? This is a really early stage company when you joined. I think bigger now, right?
The company's about 7 years old, 7-8 years old, right? But really started hitting its stride, you know, and say like the last 3 or 4 years, based here in Tampa, Florida, right? Great place to be here in Tampa. And the cool thing about Circle that's different from a lot of the other, you know, company, and you hear me getting a little excited, right? Because I'm excited about what they do, right? And that's, man, you need to be excited about where you work, right? Yeah. You need to be excited about what you do. The cool thing about them that makes them, you know, them much different than other, say, people in the hydration space that you see or you hear about is we do it all ourselves. We manufacture, we have high-speed machines that puts that cartridge together at 400 parts a minute.
So it's not something getting made some weird place. It's not like forcing a bunch of parts. This is a startup that's doing the whole thing to end. And it's in Florida, right?
Tampa, Florida. Yep, Tampa, Florida. So we got about 1 million square feet or so of manufacturing space and a little bit of office space in there, lab space. Most of it's in Tampa, Florida. We have some space out in Salt Lake City, Utah for about the last year and a half or so to service on the west side. And then we have all of our super smart people that design this stuff in our laboratory just outside of Boston. So, you know, we pull them out of those really elite schools up there on the Northeast, the ones that I would have never made it to.
If you're in Tampa and you need smart people, you have to find another city to go to.
You have to go somewhere outside Tampa. And you definitely don't want to go to Arkansas. That's for sure.
I mean, having done my time in startups, I'm going to go out on a limb here and I'm going to guess there was not a lot of security infrastructure in place when you got there. Is that true?
There was zero. And that was the challenge. That was what was exciting to me, right? So that was 2023. So at that point, I've been 23 years in, let's say, the industry, you know, WMD, crisis management, global security, public, private, mostly for large, large organizations where, and we've all been there, right? You feel like you're on this giant aircraft carrier and you're just banging your head against a wall in some cases and you're trying to turn that thing. And it's so hard to turn that ship, right? Say you come into a company and they've had a program that's been operating, you know, for a couple of years, but it's so large. I mean, this is, say it's a multi-million dollar travel risk management program, for example, or it's a multi-million dollar insider threat program or intelligence program, and it's just not working right. And the time and effort and the headache it takes to get it right, you know what I mean? It's hard on you, man. And, it, you know, it's like beating your head against the wall sometimes. So to get the opportunity literally to go to the shipyard and build your own battleship from the ground up, and if that thing doesn't float, it's on you, that's exciting to me. So you had all of that experience of what might not work so good, how you eventually got it to work the way it should have. Now let's do it the right way the first time. And I think that was the exciting part. It was the startup culture, you know, the coolness, the freshness, but it was a hell, okay, here we go, blank slate. I've always wanted to do this. Let's go.
And this is super interesting because, I mean, just from my perspective, because we were a visitor management company, it's sort of what I did most recently. You walk into a company like that and you get to start from scratch. I mean, you have material IP and manufacturing, and I mean, you have facilities and people you have to protect.
Like, oh, we have hundreds of patents.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How do you stand up something really basic like yeah, visitor management, ingress, egress,
yeah,
visible perimeter in a place like this?
Yeah.
Like, how did that work?
Yeah. So for sure, it goes back, you know, I think it really goes back to what I learned there, what I told you I learned at Walmart earlier on is learn the business, right? Understand the business. It's not as simple as coming in, and you heard me say this in New Orleans, coming in as the sheriff and laying the law down, right? Like, I'm here to lead security and I'm going to lay the law down and we're going to lock it down and we're going to guns, guards, and gates, baby. Here we go, right? It's not, you can't do that, especially in the startup culture. So you really got to learn the business and get to know your partners, get to know the leadership. And I'm very fortunate enough here to have leadership. The founders actually are still leading the company and they are very, very security conscious and very supportive of you know, my security efforts. But first thing you got to do is what's going on. This is all new to me, right? Super high speed manufacturing, hydration, technology. You know, you've got environments where we're making the flavor ourselves. So now you've got different environmental safety regulations that you've got to design your security around, right? To make sure that it complies with all of those quality and environmental and safety regulations. So you learn the business, right? You scope out the facilities, you really get in depth with them and get out there with the operational partners. And how's this machine work? And what is the flow? And how are people entering this building now, leaving the building? Okay, well, we've got hundreds of patents on this IP. This is one of one. This is the only place in the world that exists. How are we securing that? You know, what is stopping somebody else from coming in here, snapping some pictures, or walking out with some product and reinventing the wheel here or, you know, China or somewhere else? So it's educating on that risk, right? Because they, you know, they're thinking about is producing at scale, scaling as fast as possible, just like every startup, scaling as fast as possible, driving impact. But I'm like, hey, wait a minute, like you got something special here. How do we keep that secure in other people's hands off of it? Let's think about that, right? So really the way you do it, the way I did it is learn a company for your first 30 days, 60 days, and then draw out your strategic plan. And your strategic plan needs to really focus on all of your core functional global security areas, right? Access control and visitor management. How are we securing who, how are we determining who comes in these facilities, when and where they can come in, how they exit? Are we checking bags on the way out? You know, where are we placing cameras? Do we need to see that high speed machine in operation? Do we need it over the top of the operator, or do we just need a wide sweeping view, for example? You know, what are we, the outside truck drivers that are now coming into your space as well? You don't know those people, you can't vet them, but they're coming in there to pick a truckload of product up, right? To take it to, you know, Walmart, Target, or name it, right? Any of the major retailers. So, you know, build your strategy, focus on your fundamentals, right? Access control, visitor management, corporate security, insider threat, workplace violence, risk intelligence at a smaller scale, you know, a smaller company, they're not going to have necessarily the exposure that a Walmart does or a Meta does, right? But they'll get there. I mean, after a couple articles in Forbes and a couple interviews with Fox News and MSNBC and all the CEOs, the executives' names start to get out there. And then most definitely after a Super Bowl commercial, right, with Adam Devine, this last Super Bowl, your name is out there, right? So
Yeah. And look, one mistake in security, I mean, one mistake at one Walmart store, I mean, it's obviously bad. You know, you don't want it to happen. One mistake at an early stage company and
you might be finished because you might not be able to fulfill that promised order you said that you're going to deliver to, you know, a couple thousand Walmarts or Targets, and you miss that deadline. And guess what? That buyer is not going to want to mess with you anymore. So that's right. You got to be well oiled machine. So, but you know, when you're laying down your strategy in your mind, you got to think the whole time about how can I help them accomplish their mission, which is building tens of thousands of SIPs or cartridges a day, right? Or a shift, right? Building millions a month. How can I accomplish them, do that at speed, at scale, but still do it safely where we're doing it in a controlled environment, but it's not the man coming down on, right? It's not the sheriff walking around. So, you know, you really got to approach it that way. It's like, you got to be a good partner because, hey, listen, I'm here to partner with you, like manufacturing leadership, logistics and shipping, supply chain leadership. How can I help you? What are the struggles that you're running up against with checking in all these drivers that are coming to pick up the loads? What struggles are you having with temporary labor when they come to help when we have to flux or scale up really quickly for something? So you build your program to where it complements what that business is doing and it's putting a protective envelope around what that business is doing. You don't ever want to hinder what that business is doing. You know, I like to say you try to tell somebody no once. You know what I mean? In business, in government, no is no. You know, in government, if I'm telling you you're not going there, you're not going there. But, you know, in business, if I tell you you're not going there, they're going to find another way to get there. And then I'm going to get a call that says they got in trouble while they were there. You know what I mean? So you got to find a way to yes. So you got to find that way to yes. You got to, they got a job to accomplish. You need to help them accomplish that mission, that job in as safe as way, you know, as possible. So here that meant, you know, from an access control visitor management standpoint, bringing that into that million square feet of, you know, finding the right technology, finding the right vendor, hiring the right team internally to manage that, right? So I hired a security technology manager. She had previous experience with TSA and, oh, she's fantastic. You know, and to manage all those things, we're lucky enough to have our own team of electricians and maintenance folks and engineers that can help offset some of that installation cost, you know, things like that. But it's finding that technology where you're going to get the biggest return. You know, some of that technology nowadays is like these cameras, for example, that are leveraging things like AI, facial recognition, license plate reader, all of that technology. That's great. But how much of that is important to you now? How much of that are you legitimately going to use? Are you going to run everybody's license plate that comes on your property? Probably not. So it's finding that right partner from a technology space is critically important too, because they're with you for the long run. I mean, if you've got to put in 300 cameras, you're married to them for a little bit. It's serious.
You touched a little bit on the difference between the folks who sort of have the public sector background versus private sector and just needing to get to yes. But the other thing that is really interesting that you and I talked a little bit about before this call was how the generational thinking, and some of it is in fact public-private, but you've got a generation of folks that are coming into the security profession now, and it's actually, this is they're moving up the ranks, who just have, they grew up in a totally different environment than the one that like you and I came up, like cut our teeth in security. How much do you see that affecting security leadership and security talent industry-wide? I mean, how do you see that issue?
I think it's significant. You know, I think that the class of leaders that is coming in right now that is assuming these leadership roles, right, taking the reins of programs, our class of leaders is really the GWAT generation. I mean, we came up being introduced to terrorism and global war on terrorism and what that means both internationally and a lot of us participating in that internationally to keep that off of our doorstep. And then also others domestically here to keep it off of our doorstep. But there's a significant difference between, you know, that what I call the GWAT generation and the Cold War era. leader, right? So when we first entered, I know when I first entered public service, a lot of my briefs were about the Russian espionage and, you know, watch out for the Russians when you're traveling around the world doing your thing. And it was the guys, God love them. You know, but they came up in that era, and that was the threat, right? That was a risk of the time. But not to say that risk is still absolutely exists, espionage and other things at a larger scale, actually. But we're in a different era now, what I call, you know, the GWAT era, where we cut our teeth in war, right? We cut our teeth with these legitimate threats to the homeland and abroad, spending significant amount of time out there. And now we're assuming that post, being really forged in that fire. You know, the Cold War era folks, it was mostly just talking. I don't want to say all myth because it wasn't, but you know what I mean? It was talking preparedness, and there were very few that were actually mixing it up.
Yeah, 40-page long studies on, you know, the intelligence read by such and such.
And there were a few that were in there mixing it up and saw it, but our generation is much different. You know, we were really in there from the start, you know, getting our hands dirty and really forged in a totally different way. But you add that, right? So, you know, the global war on terror versus the Cold War era. But then you layer on all of this new technology boom, right, that we also grew up with. So as I was becoming a teenager, early teen, that's when the computer started coming into the classroom and then evolving computers. So everybody's technology is booming. So now we're dealing with and learning and becoming experts in this side of the house as well. And then, you know, you compound all the risk and the threat landscape that comes with that. Now it's a different threat vector that you've got to worry about. The convergence of the physical and digital. Now it's almost, you almost can't tell the difference, right? And you really got to be fairly versed at both sides of the house, where previously you didn't. Previously you were a physical security expert or you were an IT person. Now physical, digital, cybersecurity and physical security is nearly one and the same. And there's this nice gray area where they're converging. So it's a different life. And so, you know, those folks like us are coming up, we've had all that exposure. We've been hardened, in those fires. But then now, you know, now's our time to lead, right? And we're in a different time for sure. And we communicate in a different way in our cohort and the people that we're working for. I feel old at my company and I'm only 44. My founders are in their 30s.
That's part of life.
Yeah, my founders are in their 30s. So how they communicate, you know, with me and how I communicate with them and how I get the point across to them or request, you know, some money for this or that or tell them we need to do this for this upcoming trip or event is much different than previously, where you got to write a cable up, right? An official cable up through official channels, right?
The first question is, what is a cable?
What's a cable? People don't know.
Well, this kind of brings me to another question too. It's something I worry about. And you said your founders are pretty good. But if you think about the generation just behind them, call them Zs, whatever, basically the 20s, people who are in their 20s now. You sort of described our group because we've seen this merger of physical and digital threats. And I think there's, because of the GWAT sort of background, we have some understanding of just how bad the consequences are of failures. Does the 20-year-old cohort really understand this?
I mean, I'm over 20 years removed from, you know, wartime, right? And honestly, this really hit home to me here in this company because I was having a conversation with my team. And, I've got one individual that just retired from the Army. He's about my age, so he understands. And a couple of folks just a tad bit younger, but they understand. They're not in that newer generation. It was actually the anniversary of 9/11, September 11th, 2001. We were talking about that and what it means. And of course, they're showing it on the TV. And somebody from the team next door comes over. They weren't even born when 9/11 happened. Their frame of reference is completely different than ours, right? I think that they're more savvy in this tech space. I think they're probably smart enough to understand how tech is being leveraged by bad actors. But when you're talking like geopolitical risk in a larger scale, I don't think it's not on their mind. They're so focused in on the here and now, what's in front of them, what's on this device, what am I feeling now, or what is this social media feed making me feel now? They're not looking how we're looking, right? We were looking decades in the future because we knew that GWAT was going to be long term. It's going to be long, right? And it was 20 plus years. They're not, their focus is short term. in seconds versus minutes or hours or days. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch it play out. But I do think that they're in a better position than we are when you're talking about really understanding the digital risk and how to identify, how to manage it, and how to mitigate it. But I think where they're probably at the disadvantage is probably on the physical side, to be honest with you. They haven't had that. They haven't seen that in their lifetime.
Well, and unfortunately, like every generation, I think, has some moment where there's some pretty terrible. I mean, it could be a war, it could be a disaster, it could be an attack. Doesn't matter. They probably will get there. That's generally how we learn, is when something terrible happens.
It's on us. It's on our generation now. We're the leaders. We're the teachers. We don't want to be the old gray hair guys, but we are the old gray hair guys.
I don't know what happened.
I mean, you can barely see mine because I'm blonde, but it's there.
Coming, man. And, coming, everybody.
It happened just like that. And I tell you, when it sped up and when I really started to realize it's when I had my son. You know, I didn't have him until I was 40. But in the last 4 years, time has sped up, and I'm really starting to realize that I'm now the old timer. When they say old timer, that's me. Yeah.
All right.
We got to do it. We'll get them there. And the cool thing is now, just like the older generation that we came up under, you know, we heard their stories, right? We might have heard their stories of Vietnam, Panama, Grenada, Beirut, you know, things like that. And, you know, especially in the State Department, I had some leaders that were there during those first embassy bombings, right, in Nairobi, Kenya, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, you know, in the 90s where Al-Qaeda really, really started carrying out its first large-scale attack. So, you know, they had that exposure, but you're learning what it is underneath them. Now it's really interesting how that coach and player relationship is changing now. And so now we're the ones bringing up the new generation. And I think we need to take it seriously because the threat is only going to continue to escalate. We've got to get them in the right place where they're able to take the reins when we're done.
That's the job. Well, I love to wrap these conversations up with a few lightning round questions. I'm usually short. I'm just going to give you a quick one. You have not seen these in advance. All right. First, if you're new chief security officer at a startup or you're running security at a startup, what should that first security hire be for a startup?
You know, at a startup, I think the first security hire needs to be your traditional corporate security, physical security, facility security person, because at a startup, you're most likely going to have to tackle access control, visitor management, physical security first, right? You're going to have to get a hold of your facilities, right? And make sure that you've got a good handle on who's coming in, when they're coming in. So I really think you need that person on the ground that understands the security technology and the guarding, right? The man guarding of the facility. So somebody that can run with that, right? As a leader, you don't necessarily want to spend all of your time, you know, focusing on where the camera is placed in the facility, for example, or what door is the employee entrance versus what door is your emergency egress. You really need somebody to run a lot of that for you, to keep you at the strategic, keep you above the fray where you're talking about thinking about the next hire and the next hire. So I think it's really your hands-on physical security person that is well-versed in security technology as well that can help you get a hold of what you got. Get your assets undercover, get your assets secured.
Got it. What is one security myth that you wish would die?
Well, from the outside of the industry looking in, especially the younger, we just got done talking about the younger generation, is, you know, we have our own in-house officers. So I decided, instead of going with a third-party guarding service, I decided to in-house the guard team so I could control the talent, so I could control the hire, the training, build the SOPs. And what you get with that is you get a very strong team that is also bought into your mission, right? This is their company. So it's not just their post that they were put on today like a third party. This is their company, so they're bought in. But you know, we're also able to leverage them in a number of different ways. So the biggest myth I think that we need to get past, or really the outsiders need to get past when they're looking at our physical security professionals, is that they're just there to guard the door, right? They control the access and only the access. That's not true. You know, they're also the emergency first responder. My officers are also highly trained in advanced first aid, right? Tourniquets, pressure bandages, hyphen seals, all those sorts of things. My folks are going around checking CO2 levels and gauges. And I mean, they are well versed in everything. They're not just there to watch you come and go out of door. So I think that's the biggest myth, is from the outside looking into the security space, especially the corporate security space, is those officers are there just to control the door. That's not true. They do much more than that.
Awesome. All right. And one more. What is one startup security practice that you wish that your big companies had adopted? Yeah, you go back to Meta, you go back to Walmart. What's one thing that you would take from the startup environment back to those big guys?
Yeah, I think, well, you always want to say, right, the speed of decision-making, which, you know, some of these larger companies are still, look, they're everybody's faster than the government. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, when I got to Walmart from the State Department, I was like, whoa. Yeah, I mean, when I got to Walmart, I could make changes to things but just by asking one person one question. This is crazy. I don't have to run this all the way up to the undersecretary for management. Man. But now going to where it's even different, right, even faster, where you're thinking even more steps ahead. I think it's the speed of decision-making, and I think it's really the trust in your security leadership. They're making the right decision for you or attempting to make the right decision for you. Hold them accountable to that decision, but get to yes faster. Right. If you hire the right person, they're obviously going to be fiscally responsible. You know, they're going to first understand the business so they'll know what you need in a security leader. You know, don't drag them out so long in making those decisions about what vendor to bring on. Right now, if you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, big invest, obviously that's going to take time. But, you know, if you're talking about technology or vendors or even hiring practices, one or two individuals to really round out a team. Give them that leeway, get to yes faster. And that's what happens here. Really get to yes really fast and trust in that leader, because at a small company, you know those founders intimately, where at a large company, you're far more removed. I think the trust and the let them do what they do and trust that they're doing it right is what these larger companies need to adopt from these more scrappier startups. So.
Well, listen, Josh, it has been a delight get to know you. I think your bio is, I mean, just the whole story arc is a really fascinating one that a lot of security leaders can pick up a lot of nuggets from.
Sometimes I feel like Forrest Gump, you know what I mean? Like if you watch Forrest Gump,
all the greatest hits, all of the places where the terrible things were happening, you found yourself.
He's kind of adjacent to everything that happens. Sometimes he's in it, but sometimes he's just in the background, you know, he's drinking too much Dr. Pepper at the White House. And so sometimes I do feel that Forrest Gump effect, but man, I count myself lucky. I'm a guy from the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas, you know, that people trusted me enough to send me around the world to hone my skills and now trust me enough to, you know, secure their company that's on a rocket ship where the sky's the limit. Man, I'm really blessed. I couldn't see myself doing anything else than you know, this job.
And everybody can find out more about Circle at Spell It For Us, because it's not spelled the way we think it is.
It's drinkcircle.com, C-I-R-K-U-L, drinkcircle.com, or in all the major retailers, Amazon, Walmart, Target, name it, right? Sam's Club, Costco.
Well, thank you, Josh. It's been fun, and have an awesome holiday season, and look forward to the next time we talk.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sign-In Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit signinsolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed.